The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
The publication of this lecture, Coping with Grief, was made possible through a generous grant given in the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas Avram Yitzchak Ben Shlomo, Olive Shalom, Mr. Alfred Ivor Stebbins of blessed memory.
It has been said that if one does not believe in a God, there are many difficult questions in life. How did the universe come into existence? The consensus of scientific thought is that it had a definite beginning. Because before that time, there was no universe. How did it come into existence? How is it that all of existence, throughout all the universe, we have little atoms that are virtually identical? In the middle is your nucleus, has the proton, sometimes the neutron. Going around it at amazing speeds are the electrons, and they are all the same throughout all the universe. And they're like little Legos, building blocks, that from these atoms one creates molecules. How did it all come about? How did life come about on this planet? If you look at the smallest organism, you look at the cell. Every cell is a miniature chemical factory creating untold number of chemicals. And in the heart of that cell is a nucleus that contains chromosomes that in turn contains genes. And those genes are made up of DNA. An amazing array of four chemicals that are the code of all of life. And the future of every organism and all its chemical activities is mapped out in the DNA of every single cell. How did conscious life, sentient life, come about on this planet? After all, we're not a form of other molecules. We have feelings. We have a sense of consciousness. We have a sense of morality. We have the ability to create, to design computers, send a man to the moon. We have the ability to write beautiful verse, moving poetry, compose beautiful music. How did all of that come about? These are just some of the many questions one has to deal with if one does not take into account a God. But on the other side, that if one does believe that there is a God, there is one question, a question so difficult that perhaps it outweighs all the other questions. How is it that if there's a God who designed this world, who designed everything from the atom to the cell, to our minds, to our feelings, how could he have created such a flawed world with such suffering? And it's because of this question that so many have abandoned the belief in a God, despite the overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Because how do you explain it? The question of suffering on an intellectual basis, when bad things happen to good people, and on an emotional basis, coping with grief, is the subject of tonight's lecture. I hope each one of you have a handout. It's not crucial, but it'll be helpful. And I've arranged the topics that we'll discuss tonight. And first we'll have the lecture. And afterwards we'll have a short question and answer period, and I'll be around by the refreshments to answer any one's individual questions. I've divided this lecture into 9 parts. And forming the acronym of the word suffering. The first is the idea of a soul. One of the basic ideas of Judaism is that our consciousness, and as you ask yourself, who am I? Like, close your eyes. Where's the me? Where's the conscious me? It's not your hands, it's not your feet. What is your identity? What makes you, you? And the answer in Jewish tradition, as well as in the tradition of virtually every culture on this earth, is that our being is a spiritual entity. If you notice, in the first page of the notes, this is on page 2, for soul, we quote a passage in Pirkei Avos. But beloved is man that he is created in the image of God. It's a mark of superabundant love that not only he created us in his image, but he made us aware of our tremendous potential. He made us aware of that fact. According to our beliefs, it fills vast tomes of the Talmud. It's in the works of Josephus. Precedes it in the works of the Bible. When our body ceases to function, our consciousness leaves the body and goes to another plane. There is no, in this sense, there is no true death. There's no, the idea that when one dies, his consciousness has finished. The person is totally destroyed, is foreign to Jewish tradition. It's really foreign to the tradition virtually every group in this world. But it's not just a matter of faith. A little over 20 years ago, a doctor published a book. It was a very small book put out by a small publishing house. It became an international bestseller, and it was called Life After Life. And in it, Dr. Raymond Moody describes, it's anecdotal, he describes as there was 100-some cases, the people that he interviewed, who claimed that they had what is now known as a near-death experience. They had the sense that they had died. Their consciousness left the body. And they were able to view events outside of their body. In many instances, those that were revived told stories about how their consciousness left their body. They were hovering near the ceiling of the room, looking down, seeing the operation, and were able to recount in tremendous detail what had occurred to them during the operation when they were technically unconscious. As these people had cardiac arrest, they had their vital signs, they were clinically dead, and yet they were able to recount in great detail, people with virtually no medical knowledge, about what happened to them in the room. There are instances, and there are quite a few, of those who claimed, and we weren't there, as we could only listen to their claim, but their claim was They had left the operating room, in other words, their consciousness, and went across the hall to the waiting room. I'd like to quote for you a subsequent book by Raymond Moody about one of those incidents to give you a sense of what kind of stories are these people telling us. Another woman had an out-of-body experience and left the room where her body was being resuscitated. At least this is her claim. From across the hospital lobby, she watched her brother-in-law as some business associate approached him and asked what he was doing in the hospital. "Well, I was going out of town on a business trip," said the brother-in-law. "But it looks like June is going to kick the bucket, so I better stay around to be a pallbearer." I guess she had heard enough. A few days later, when she was recovering, the brother-in-law came to visit. She told him that she was in the room as he spoke to his friend, and erased any doubt by saying, "Next time I die, you go off on your business trip, because I'll be just fine." He turned so pale she thought he was about to have a near-death experience. This is not uncommon. Besides the stories that they tell about their consciousness leaving the body, being on this earth, and describing events very often in great detail, in a majority of cases, they also tell about going to the next world. And that they tell again in great, with great emotion, as if it really occurred. In the handouts, that you should have one of these pages. This is based on the research of Dr. Michael Sabon, a cardiologist in Atlanta, Georgia, who after reading Dr. Moody's book was very skeptical, until he himself started interviewing his patients. Eventually, he conducted a whole study, and the result of that study are these figures over here. There are over 100 patients who claimed that they had some sort of near-death experience. They were all clinically dead. In other words, they didn't have the vital signs. The people who reported this was between a quarter and a third of all the patients that he had interviewed told this story. And if you see, there are 13 signs of what had occurred to these people. All of them had the sense that they had died, that they were separated from their body, a feeling of calm and tranquility. In a majority of cases, 53%, they observed physical objects and events. They had left their body and described what had occurred outside their body. 54%, they described entering a transcendental environment, as what we would call the next world. What they described is a world pleasure would be really an improper term. It was such a sense of well-being. They had the sense of love, of feeling love, the sense of the importance of life, of self-improvement, of gaining knowledge. And they came back so changed that there have been various studies made, particularly one that I've recently read from Dr. Melvin Morse, that these people are basically totally changed individuals after what they claim is this experience. In many instances, they claim, and according to Dr. Sabam's, who was some 28%, they had seen a being of light. Some called it God, some called it an angel. But they felt that there was a being who loved them, who cared for them. It parallels very well Judaic sources, Midrashic sources, that right before a person dies, the Shekhinah comes to greet the person. The divine presence on earth. And it came back to change people. What's so interesting is that these figures basically do not change if the person is young or the person is old, he's well educated or not, he has a religious education or a religious inkling or not. It seems that none of these factors factor in to the core experience. In fact, as Dr. Melvin Morse, who's a pediatrician in Seattle, Washington, made various studies of small children having near-death experiences. They weren't exposed to any, they had no media exposure. We're not biased by anything that they saw or they heard, and yet virtually it's the same experience. If you notice, I have attached to this, and some of it's in the back page of others, a suggested reading list. I wouldn't want you to take my word for this. I'd like you to continue on your own research. There's a tremendous body of evidence. One of this, the first citation here is a book by George Gallup from the Gallup poll. And according to his interviews and based on his statistical methodology, there are some 8 million individuals in the United States who had some sort of near-death experience. Some 2 million who had the full out-of-body experience. It's amazing. It's a lot of people. If you notice, one of the books for suggested reading is At the Hour of Death by Osis and Haraldson. This is a work that describes the reactions of people as they were dying. In other words, this is not a near-death experience or people who came back and describe various events or experiences. These are people who died. And the people that were interviewed were doctors and nurses that were at the bedside of those that died. And what doctors Osis and Haraldson did is they made a cross-cultural study of two groups, one in the United States and one in India. So basically to get the sense of what experiences are biased by culture. Now, the Indian culture, the assumption, is very different than the American culture. According to his findings, the experiences are basically the same. In many, many instances, 1,000 instances that he had described, the people had an inkling that they saw the next world. At least this is what they described. There was a whole mood change, if it was a positive, those positive instances, is that they died with a smile on their face. In many instances, they claimed that they saw deceased relatives who came, this is their claim, to escort them to the next world. There's a parallel to this in the near-death experiences. If you notice, again, on the first page, on item number 12, encountering others, almost half of them claimed that there were some beings who came to escort them to the other world. And in the Zohar, this is the classic book of Jewish mysticism, also describes this phenomenon of deceased relatives coming to escort the dying to the next world. I would just like to read for you, before we go on to the next phase here, one of the incidents which are described in Osis and Haraldson's book, The Hour of Death. This was reported by a nurse who was a deathbed of a man in his 40s, and I believe this happened in India. He was unsedated, fully conscious, and had a low temperature. He was a rather religious person and believed in life after death. We expected him to die, and he probably did too, as he was asking us to pray for him. In the room where he was lying, there was a staircase leading to the second floor. I guess they make hospitals different over there. Suddenly he exclaimed, "See, the angels are coming down the stairs. The glass has fallen and broken." Those were his words. All of us in the room looked towards the staircase where a drinking glass had been placed on one of the steps. As we looked, we saw the glass break into 1,000 pieces without any apparent cause. It did not fall. It simply exploded. The angels, of course, we did not see. A happy and peaceful expression came over the patient's face, and the next moment he expired. Even after his death, the serene, peaceful expression remained on his face. The idea that we survive bodily death has many ramifications and goes beyond the scope of this particular lecture. But anyone who has experienced someone close to them who died, departed, it's a tremendous comfort. It's not an answer. And when there's a death of someone close to you, the person themselves died. It's a parent or a close relative or a close friend. But it's a tremendous comfort to feel that the person who died went to a better place. Besides the tradition of Judaism and the tradition of mankind, it's a great comfort to know that there's a tremendous body of evidence to support this notion. But why is it, and we're just begging the question again, what is the purpose, why is it that suffering exists? And that comes to the next part, the next topic that begins with you. And as the S was soul, you is understanding. And the Talmud has a whole discussion and interprets an incident that occurred with Moshe Rabbeinu, with Moses. That Moses himself was puzzled and had no inkling as to what is the system. Again, if we assume that there is a God who designed this system, the atomic system, the cellular system, how does suffering fit in? And Moses asked the question. And according to one opinion in the Talmud, he was given an answer. And I'd like to go briefly over what would be the second answer. This is the middle of the second paragraph. The Lord said thus to Moses, "A righteous man who prospers is a perfectly righteous man." He asked, why is it? He doesn't understand. There are people that seem to be righteous and they do well. People who seem to be righteous and suffer terribly. And And those are who seem to be very miserable people, I mean, wicked people, people that are undeserving, seem to do very well, at least some of them. What's the system? And the answer is basic. You see, that the system of suffering, and this is a very difficult concept, and again, we'll leave the expansion of this for the question and answers, is that we, mankind, is accountable. We said before, we posited the idea, we have a soul. We existed before we came in our physical bodies, and we will exist after we leave our physical bodies. What are we doing here then? So what are we doing here? If the purpose of life is to try to squeeze out every drop of pleasure that we can, whether it be in terms of physical pleasure or status, seems, I mean, just that's what life is all about. If people describe in such glowing terms what it is after death, and most of us don't have that in life, what are we here for? And the answer, and again, this is the answer that the classic Judaism has, Talmud has, it's the answer that every major religion has, is we are here to perfect ourselves. We come, in a sense, we come like a block of marble or a piece of clay. And through life, we form and reform ourselves. That reformation, that change in character, the idea that we try to perfect ourselves and try to do good and perfect the world about us, is why we're here. And we are held accountable for, in essence, to the extent that we fulfill this mission. That basically is the notion. It would seem, in a certain sense, a very simplistic notion. Okay, you understand somebody who's terribly rotten should suffer. Someone who's doing well, everything should be fine. And this is the problem that Moshe had, but it doesn't seem to work that way. And the answer that was given was really based on two considerations. One, that the judgment is not just in this world. It's a long time. We're just here for 70, 80 some years. This God has a long time. We don't have to see the whole story here. It goes way beyond our lifetime. And even righteous people are imperfect. I mean, this is the basic notion. There's a second basic notion, is that, as we've described before, those who had near-death experiences, the reward of being a good person cannot be given here. There's nothing that can be given to a person here on this earth that is a satisfactory reward of being an upright and fine individual. Can you imagine, just for example, you have a neighbor who has a swimming pool, has a little infant who's just crawling. And while one of the parents was on the phone talking, and the sliding door to the patio and to the pool was open, the toddler crawled out of the house onto the patio and fell into the pool. And the mother was totally in shock when she heard the splash. She started screaming. It was uncontrollable. A neighbor heard her screams, jumped over the fence, dived into the pool, say, brought the child out, performed artificial respiration, revived the child. Does he save the child's life? This neighbor saved the child's life, saved the mother's sanity, or the father's sanity, saved their marriage. What could that parent give the neighbor? A candy bar? New stereo set? New car? There's nothing that can repay that act of goodness. There's just nothing. And that is the notion that we are here in this world. I mean, this is a classic Jewish notion, to be challenged to improve ourselves, but this is not the place where we're going to be rewarded. Because there's nothing that they can give us here for all the good that we can do. This may be an answer. The idea that the imperfect person, as you read in the notes, suffers in this world and it's finished. He suffers in this world, he's perfected, goes on to the next world. The incorrigible person enjoys this life. There's nothing, there's no life beyond this. But what do we say to a person who has a child, or a person himself who has been born with severe handicaps, who's been abused as a child? There's no way to connect any misdemeanors, any faults and behavior to what he's suffering. And that takes us to the next letter. This is the F. The first F is for fate. A very difficult concept, but hopefully will be made a little easier. When a new child is born in a family, we say Mazel Tov. What does Mazel Tov mean? I mean, it's a wish for good. I mean, but what does Mazel mean? The idea of Mazel, as it's brought in the Talmud, is related to the idea of fate. And here we have a quote on page 3, the Talmud Moed Katan 28a. Rava said, the length of life, children, and sustenance depend not on merit, but rather on mazel. And it goes on to quote two great people. It would seem on the surface both great, conscientious, exemplary people. Yet one lived a life of suffering and the other lived a life of great prosperity. Rava's answer was, it's mazel. Reminds you of this, you know, que sera, sera. Doesn't sound very Jewish. What's mazel based on? How could that be? 200 years ago, there lived one of the greatest scholars of the modern era in the city of Vilna. His name was Rav Eliyahu, and he was known as the Vilna Gaon, the great eminence of the city of Vilna. And he writes that the notion of mazel is based on a fundamental concept in the Kabbalah, in the Jewish mystical tradition. The idea of reincarnation. The notion of reincarnation is, this is not necessarily the first time we've been here on this earth. It's a notion which forms the core of Eastern religions. The Zohar, the basic classical mystic text in Judaism, spends much time, discussing this principle. And there's been much scientific research to support the idea that our consciousness, not only, as we said, the near-death experiences, leaves our body, but also the notion, at least the possibility, that we have been here before. And if that's the case, and I will describe just again very briefly one or two cases here. But if one assumes that, then basically one has does not have any notion then of why someone is suffering. One has the idea, well, it's a long life, you know, I just don't have any answers. But one can't point to say, ask the question, but he's such a wonderful person. Why should he suffer? Well, how long have you known him? Only 70 years. That's a gomish. Let me just read to you. I'm just going to take a little snippet of this. This is taken from a book. It's called A Critical Examination of the Belief in Life After Death by C.J. Ducasse, who's a professor of philosophy emeritus at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. And he describes the story, very famous story, of Shanta Devi. Shanta Devi was a girl who was born in 1926 in Delhi, India, who from the time she was 4 years old began to speak about a former life of hers in great detail. And she claimed that her husband of a former life lived in the city of Mathura. This is 100 kilometers from Delhi. It was finally arranged, because she said this is where he is and this is his address and this is where he lives. She sent this was a retired principal who had heard her story, sent an address to this man's name on that street in Mathura. The girl had never been in Mathura. He had never been in Mathura. He sent it and he got a reply that he was the person, and he had a wife that who had died, had borne him a child. And he was very curious. He first sent a cousin of his, who happened to live in Delhi, to interview her. He was very impressed. Finally, he himself came. And let me just read to you. And this is Kedarnath Chaubey. This is the husband of the woman that had died in Mathura. On November 13th, 1935, came to Delhi with his present wife and his 10-year-old son by his former wife. Shanta Devi recognized Kedarnath and was greatly moved, answering convincingly various questions asked by him about private matters of her former life as his wife, and mentioning that she had buried 150 rupees in a certain room of her house in Mathura. After they left, she kept asking to be taken to Mathura, describing various features of the town. On November 24, 1935, she and her parents, and this is the three, there were three individuals. One was a managing editor of the Daily Tej, one was a leader of the nationalist movement, and one was a lawyer who escorted her to Mathura. She had never been there before. On the railway platform, an elderly man in the group of people there paused for a moment in front of her, and she recognized him, saying that he was her Jeff, the elder brother of her former husband. And it goes on, the party then took a carriage whose driver was instructed to follow whatever route the girl told him. She mentioned that the road to the station had not been asphalted when she lived in Mathura, things have improved. And she pointed out various buildings which had not existed then. She led the party to the lane in which was a house she had formerly occupied. And the story goes on. And finally she came to the last house that she lived. She pointed to the spot. Says, here's the money that's buried, the 150 rupees. They dug it up and all there was an empty box. She turned to her former husband. And she claimed in Indian, says, Avu de Gelt, in other words, where's the money? What did you do with it? And he said that shortly after the wife had died, he had taken out the money and spent it. This is only one of a vast literature of reincarnation memories. And again, in the suggested reading, the last two from Dr. Ian Stevenson, who did extensive research into this, there are two of his books. He wrote many books, which are worthwhile. Let's just summarize what we have so far. We started off dealing with the problem of suffering. How could a God who created such an unfathomable, amazing system of matter and energy and molecules and cells and people with the ability to create computers and write music, how could he have created this suffering? How does it fit in? How is it possible? We went on to discuss three notions. One is the idea of soul, that what we are, and besides traditional sources, there's much scientific evidence to support this as well, our consciousness survives our body. And we are here, that's the you of understanding, we are here to improve ourselves and we are held accountable. The idea of fate, is we are held accountable even for beyond this lifetime. Before we go on, I'd like to just share again with you another source. This is not part of the reading list. It's an amazing book. It is written by Dr. Brian Weiss, who at the time of writing was the head of the Department of Psychiatry, Mount Sinai Hospital in Miami. And the name is Many Lives, Many Masters. Dr. Breuer, the teacher of Sigmund Freud, discovered a tool in psychiatry which was used extensively by Freud. That's known as the talking cure. Many times we have things that lay deep inside of us, but as we discuss them and bring them to the surface, we have a much better grasp of them. And very often our unease, our phobias, our neuroses, are lightened, or in some instances go away entirely when we bring these deep-seated memories out into the open. This Dr. Weiss had a very difficult patient. Otherwise she was normal, she didn't have neuroses, but she had these phobias. She didn't understand why she has the fear of this and the fear of that. Otherwise, she was a very pleasant girl. She was nominally Catholic. For a year and a half, he used traditional psychoanalytic methods on her to go back to her past. There was almost no relief. Somehow, and he was using hypnosis, somehow, in the process of hypnotizing her, he brought her back and he said, I want you to remember the source of your problems, and she described life in ancient Egypt. And what she described was her life, this is the story that came out, living in Egypt many thousands of years ago. And through speaking to her, at least this is how it went, many lives came out. What makes this story so interesting is that she described not only living these lives, and by the way, in describing when she died, she described the near-death experience as it was described by Dr. Moody and other researchers. She described her death, in other words, in the same feelings just as the others had. She described that she had the experience of masters. This is called Many Lives, Many Masters. These master spirits who guided her. This is similar to a Talmudic notion that everyone has a malach, everyone has an angel. And these masters were guiding her, were trying to at least. And he was very skeptical. He had been raised, his father had been a member of a conservative synagogue, but as he described, he was a person that was more ritualistic rather than truly spiritual. And his bias was secular. And despite all the that had occurred and all that she told him, he was still very skeptical. Until she told him the following story. Under one of these sessions, she claimed, "Your father is here." She sees the neshama, she's the soul of the deceased father, and your son, who was a small child. He had a child that was born with a rare heart condition that the ventricles and the atrium were switched around, and the child only lived for a short period of time. This woman had no knowledge of his life. Their relationship was purely professional. And here, under hypnosis, she claims, says, "Your father is here, and your son, who's a small child. Your father says you will know him because his name is Avram." His Hebrew name. He didn't go by that name. He was Alvin. When he got an aliyah in shul, and that's when they called him up to the Torah, they called him Avram. He was rarely ever used. I guess that shul is like our shuls. You know, you don't get an aliyah to him. "And your daughter is named after him." She named his own daughter, named Amy, is a tribute to this Avram. "Also, his death was due to his heart." And then it says, "This was the sign that you'll know who he is. Your son's heart was also important, for it was backward like a chicken's. He made a great sacrifice for you out of his love. His soul is very advanced. His death satisfied his parents' debts. Also, he wanted to show you that medicine could only go so far, that its scope is very limited." After his child had died, and he was contemplating going into internal medicine, and he decided, as a result of seeing the limitations of medical science, to go into psychiatry. It was this incident that she claimed to be contacting the souls of the departed spirits that convinced him that what she was saying was really true. I mean, there was no way, at least what he claims, that she would have any knowledge of what the father's Hebrew name was, or the child's medical condition. This is only one work, and again, this is a whole literature, of people who claim under hypnosis to have recollection of a previous life. What's very noteworthy here is, again, that it seems to be the Jewish notion that the death of the child was somehow connected to the spiritual level of the parent that suffered, and B, that this child was put on this earth just for that purpose. It was a very advanced soul. It was a child that had lived before and who came here just for that purpose. It's an amazing, it's worthwhile to read the book. It's an amazing, again, the F is fate. And again, we will quickly go through the other topics. We spend more time here because I think that some of these ideas are new. The next F is faith. Assuming all of this, assuming that one has the sense that he is truly a spiritual being, that he has a mission in life, he's going to be, he was perhaps here before, he may come back again. How does one accept suffering, though? If chas v'sholom, God forbid, something happens, what's the reaction? here on page 3, we quote the Talmud Gemara in Brachos and Samach Amud Beis in 60b. One, just briefly, is the notion, this is, if God forbid something terrible happens, there's a bracha made, there's a blessing made, Baruch Dayan Emes. There's the sense that God, who is the righteous judge, was involved somehow in this. Things just don't happen. And the second idea, which we have on page 4, is that everything that happens, since God is in charge, happens for the best. And it tells over a little story with Rabbi Akiva. And again, that may be atypical of your own experiences. Rabbi Akiva came to a town. He was alone. He had a donkey. He had a rooster to wake him up in the morning. He had a lamp. He had nothing else. And he wanted a place to stay, and no one let him in. I don't know what your reaction would have been. Just put yourself in that situation. You're tired, you're lonely, you need a place to be, and no one lets you in. Rabbi Akiva's reaction was, everything that God does is for the best. He went into the forest. And while he was in the forest trying to sleep, a lion came and devoured his donkey. A weasel came and ate the rooster. A wind came and extinguished his light. He had absolutely nothing left. And he kept on saying, everything that God does is for the best. During that night, a band of marauders came to that town and took everyone captive and sold them as slaves. Had Rabbi Akiva been there, had they extended their hospitality to him, he would have been a slave. Had they been aware of his presence in the forest, had they seen the light or heard the braying of the donkey or the crowing of the rooster, his position would have been given away and they would have gone after him. This is not always the case. But very often in life, looking back, what seemed to be at the time the worst tragedy, in retrospect, wasn't so gefährlich. Wasn't so bad. So the F is faith. There's a sense, if God designed the world, created the soul, is in charge basically of my life, there's a faith that he's still with me. Even though Rabbi Akiva didn't understand what was happening, he just had the faith that he's being taken care of. The E, we went through S, the soul, U is understanding, F, the first one is fate, second one is faith, E is evolution. Very often, and this is the quotation here, through life, sometimes, very often we change, we mellow. Some of the rough edges and the arrogance we carry with us, after we've been humbled, we become much better people. The Talmud speaks about suffering as a purification. That's one aspect of suffering. There's another aspect of suffering. I have no idea where Adolf Hitler, Yimach Shemoy, and his ilk are. But according to Jewish tradition and my own personal sensitivities, it would be a terrible thing if a people who have caused so much misery and suffering in this world should go and leave this world, experience this glorious near-death experience, and live happily ever after. There has to be an accounting. And that's the notion of retribution, that there's justice. We may not see it in this world. It's a long time. It may not be just one lifetime. But there's the notion, the R of retribution, that God is in charge. One of the most terrible things, if one suffers at the hands of someone else, is to see that the person gets off scot-free. The idea of retribution is, the Jewish notion is, it's a long life, beyond this life. And no one gets away free. You know, it's like you could run, but you can't hide. I is investment. This is on the last page. We often have a very childish notion about the idea of heaven. It's open for everybody. You just have to merit. You go in. The pearly gates are there and it's open for you. Everyone builds his own heaven. You build your own life. What you will receive and how you are dealt with is directly related to what you invested in your life in this world. The quote here from Pirkei Avos is, "This world is like a vegetable before the world to come. Prepare yourself. This world, what we're here for is to do, is to create, to make ourselves better, to make the world better. And to the effort that we put in, that's the fruit that will be born." There's a very, very cute story about one of the great rabbis of pre-World War II Europe, known by his pen name, the Chofetz Chaim. It was a great work, a classic work that he wrote. And the story is told of a Jew whose origins were from the old country. He moved to Chicago. And later in his life, he came back to Europe, wanted to see how it was, and he heard about this famous rabbi who wanted to visit him. And he came to his home, and he lived in a very modest condition. And he was taken aback. He said, "A person of such stature should not have the amenities that he, this person from Chicago, was used to." And he asked him, "Rebbe," he says, "Avur zar mebel, you know, Rabbi, where's your furniture?" I mean, he had chairs and tables, but he didn't have furniture. And he didn't answer immediately, but as the conversation went on, he asked him, "You know, by the way, you know," he says, "where's your furniture? Like, where's your furniture?" "This is my furniture, you know, it's in Chicago, you know. I'm just passing through." So he says, "I'm also just passing through." And that's a difference. With that attitude, you don't dismiss the reversals in life, but it takes on a whole different coloring. Because if you're passing through, if you're on the train, and the conductor's rude to you, and the service is bad, but you know, your relatives are going to be there at the end of the trip to greet you and everything. So you take it, you know what I mean? If you think, you know, this train ride is forever, it's bad news. But if you know that you're just passing through, emotionally it's a lot easier to take. I is an investment. We're here to make an investment in our lives. The N in the G stand for nature and God. And I will just briefly touch upon this very important subject, and then I'll leave the floor open to questions. We have spoken, up until now, we've spoken about the idea of my purpose on life, the idea of suffering in life as part of my growth, part of accountability. But there seem to be situations where one would say that it would seem on the surface, well, God doesn't seem to have a hand in this. If I would go take a trip to Bosnia, Bosnia is a little better now, you know, but I would take to Rwanda. I would take one of the hot spots of this on this globe. I would take a tour through Afghanistan and walk through the minefields. And something Chas v'Shalom would happen. They'd say, where was God? Where were you? How do you let this happen? There is a dual notion here. One is, it's possible for a person to commit suicide. A person could kill himself, a person could maim himself. A person could spend his whole life ruining his lungs and his heart through smoking. And you can't go back and ask, God, where were you? Why didn't you save me? We have the free will to harm ourselves. But there's another notion. When we don't directly harm ourselves, we put ourselves in a compromising position. We walk in under a bridge that's holding our thoughts. In other words, that's on the verge of collapse. Here the Talmud tells us a fascinating and a very important principle. Normally, this person, if he'd been at home, nothing would have happened to the person. The fact is, he put himself in that compromising position. For him to be saved, God has to make a miracle for the person. I mean, God has to intervene in his life. I mean, the mind shouldn't go, but you know, you just shouldn't step where the mines are, you know, or the bridge shouldn't collapse. To be worthy, to have a miracle done for a person has to be very worthy. And what happens is, when a person's in that situation, his books are opened, his life is re-examined, should we intervene? They normally wouldn't have done anything. I mean, he'd be home, he'd be safe. But if a person puts himself into a dangerous situation, a miracle may occur, but don't bank on it. That's the end of nature. Very often, we cause our own suffering. And the suffering that we cause is very often psychological as well. It's terrible when you lose somebody. It's just terrible. The person's life is part of the person is gone. But what complicates the matters is that we often compound this with our own self-inflicted suffering. We have the guilt. Why did I survive? We eat ourselves up. We become obsessed with our unfortunate situation. We can't blame everything, you know, on God. I mean, there's so much. But there's a point in our lives that we say, how much of what I'm suffering is my own? That's nature. There's a sense that a person has a certain amount of control over his life. That no matter how bad things are, that you could always make it worse. And the last G, God, again, is a reiteration of this principle, and it's a beautiful idea. This is taken from a Gemara in the Talmud of Chulin in Zion Amud Beis in 7b. No man bruises his finger here on earth, lest it so decreed against him in heaven. Ultimately, God is with us. I mean, we may have put ourselves in a compromising position, but there's a decision made. We are not alone. And that idea that we live together with a God who designed us and who takes care of us and who leads us on, prods us onto our mission, is really the basis of what traditionally Jews have always looked at life. And therapeutically, it's a system that one could go through life. Ultimately, saving a lot of grief, adding a great dimension of happiness. And I'd like to leave now the floor open to any questions.
Well, I don't know where to start. It's kind of a heavy notion to think that some of the suffering that we go through is self-inflicted.
Well, there's, I'll give an example. I mean, let me repeat the question. Yeah. The question that was asked, it's a very difficult notion, you know, to have that sense that one, that the suffering that one has is self-inflicted. Right? That's a question. I don't know how many psychiatric social workers, psychologists are here in the audience. But they will attest to the fact that a great portion of the suffering that we have, besides, of course, the core suffering, I mean, whatever incident that triggered it, but there goes beyond that core suffering. There's a whole entire layer built upon this that normally a psychologist will tell you is unnecessary. There's a beautiful, let me just say with a beautiful story here, just to illustrate this, and maybe this will just make it a lot easier. We had here in the notes here on page 3, there's a Mishnah that says that a person is required to make a blessing for if evil, chas v'shalom, God forbid, befalls him, just as when good happens. A person should make a blessing. And the Talmud asks, what do you mean? It's a different blessing. What do you mean? It's not the same blessing. And the Talmud answers, to accept it with happiness. That's the answer. It's a difficult answer. Yeah. It's just as something good, a baby is born, I mean, you know, things that, you know, I mean, that the whole house brightens up. And what makes a blessing? One says it with happiness. So if chas v'sholem, you know, God forbid, something tragic happens, one should say it with happiness. You know, you say, Baruch atah Hashem, you're thanking God for giving you this experience. I mean, the idea is that the experience is purifying, whatever it is, it's part of God's program to lead you on. Yeah, I'm not finished yet. What? Yeah.
Whether you happen to like
it. Right, that's right. That's right. There's a beautiful story regarding this that's told over. One of the early Hasidic masters, the leaders of the Hasidic movement, is Rav Dov Ber of Mizritch. After the founder of the Hasidic movement, the Baal Shem Tov, passed away, he carried the mantle of leadership. And to him was attracted many great scholars that eventually left their impact on world Jewry. Two of those scholars were two brothers, Reb Elimelech. There's the Reb Shmelka says, and Reb Pinchas Horowitz, who later on led great communities in Europe. And they came to the Rebbe, asked him, we don't understand this passage in the Talmud. How could it be? How could it be that you could ask of someone to accept something that happened? You know, it's suffering in the same manner that one accepts something which is good. It's impossible. So Reb Dov Ber said, there's only one person who could answer this question. And that's Zisha. Amongst, again, the disciples of this Rebbe, again, there were two brothers, Reb Elimelech and Reb Zisha, who, again, a tremendous impact on world Jewry. They went to Reb Zisha, he lived in utter poverty, came to a hovel, it was dark. They came to him and they saw the situation was like unbearable in their house. And they came to him and they told over this question. They quoted the Talmud, the passage in the Talmud, and their question, how is it possible that a person emotionally could deal with suffering the same way as with good? And he said, and the Rebbe told, says, Rav Dov said that you're the one to answer the question. And he looked at them and just, I don't understand. And the least qualified person on earth to answer this question. I've never had a bad day in my life. That is, he was happy. He said, I never suffered. You know, that's the, he did suffer. He didn't suffer. And we're saying about a person who suffered, right? We're saying a person who went through terrible suffering. But his attitude was such, and his faith was such, that it didn't affect his psychological well-being.
It was set up to happen.
Yeah, that's how he accepted it. Yeah. What do you mean?
Instead of... He said we were put on this world to protect ourselves. Well, maybe suffering is God's challenge.
That's part of it. But there is, I'm just saying, there was a mention here, and then after I'll take at least one more question, then we could do it privately. I could answer a question. We discussed some of the ideas of suffering, you know, about the idea of retribution to Hitler and his ilk, the idea of evolution, in other words, that we change through suffering. Part of the notion of suffering is also the idea of a challenge. You know, we are given opportunities in life. I heard a story today, just to share with you, just opportunities. It's not germane to this issue, but just to give you a sense. Tremendous story. Just a short period, a while ago, someone came to one of the wealthier members of the New York community and had an organization that was in desperate of funds, and they couldn't make the payroll, that week's payroll, and asked for a loan of $30,000. The person refused it. He can't afford it, can't make. He refused it. A few minutes later, that same fellow who refused to make the loan got a call about a tremendous investment opportunity. And he put in $2 million into an investment opportunity. He lost every penny. Evidently, this person had a chat. Again, I'm not in God's shoes to say exactly what happened. We are constantly challenged. Some people have the wherewithal to do this. Others have different talents. But we are constantly challenged. That's what life is all about. When we suffer, we're also challenged. How will we react? We will forget everything. Or we won't lose sight of our goal. My son, my little 12-year-old son, just took out of the library a few books about World War I and World War II. And I like to read his stuff, you know, the things he takes out. And I was reading about the Marine invasion in World War II of the Pacific Islands, and how they conquered the Japanese forces until they were finally victorious. There's tremendous death. You know what I mean? They were going on these islands and thousands of Marines died. You can imagine as they're going, this person's falling, the same the guy in their platoon, this one's falling on this side and that side and the other side. What keeps them going? Because they have that sense of mission. I think for every human being, you know, I mean, this is really what the Talmud inculcates. We have to have a sense of mission. If we have that sense of mission, the suffering is still suffering. We're seeing that added layer. Yeah. Yes. This will take this last question.
How do you respond to neurophysiologists that report that when the brain dies, there's a release of endorphins and neurotransmitters, all of which creates a sense of well-being, of calm, and of life? How do you explain the neurophysiological explanation for all the things that are listed on this list?
Right. Two things. First of all, the idea of the release of the chemicals in the brain don't explain the out-of-body experience. That a person could go describe events in the room and outside of the room. Second, that's the first person. The second is that there is no research to support that. It is just a theory that one will, in light of this evidence, that perhaps that this is the cause. But again, it's not an answer, perhaps an answer for well-being, but it's not an answer to the virtual identical detail of those who go through this tunnel, who see their deceased relatives, who communicate with this being of light. Those experiences are not easily explained with the feeling, this chemical rush of well-being. It just makes you feel good. But it does not explain the detail and the identical detail of these people.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.